The Celestine Prophecy, Cassette 6.
The Interpersonal Ethic. I followed the soldier up the steps and out into the bright sunshine. Pablo's warning was echoing in my head. Addiction to another person? What did he mean by that? What kind of addiction? The soldier led me down the path toward the parking area where two other soldiers stood beside a military jeep. They watched us intensely as we walked their way. When I was close enough to see inside the jeep, I noticed that a passenger was already sitting in the back. Marjorie. She looked pale and anxious. Before I could catch her eye, the soldier behind me grabbed my arm and directed me into the seat beside her. Two other soldiers climbed into the front seats. The one sitting on the driver's side glanced back at us briefly. Then he started the vehicle and headed north. "Do you speak English?" I asked the soldiers. The soldier in the passenger seat, a beefy man, looked at me blankly and said something in Spanish that I couldn't understand, then turned curtly away. I turned my attention to Marjorie. "Are you all right?" I asked in a whisper. Her voice faded and I noticed tears were flowing down her face. "It's going to be okay," I said, putting my arm around her. She looked up at me, forcing a smile, then rested her head on my shoulder. A ripple of passion filled my body. For an hour, we bounced along the unpaved road. Outside, the landscape grew continuously more lush and jungle-like. Then, around one bend, the dense vegetation opened up into what appeared to be a small town. Wood-frame buildings lined both sides of the road. 100 yards ahead, a large truck blocked the way. Several soldiers motioned for us to stop. Beyond them were other vehicles, some with flashing yellow lights. I became more alert. As we pulled to a stop, one of the soldiers outside walked up and said something I couldn't understand. The only word I recognized was gasoline. Our escorts left the jeep and stood outside talking with the other soldiers. They glanced at us occasionally, weapons at their side. I noticed a small street which angled to the left. As I looked at the shops and doorways, something changed in my perception. The shapes and colors of the building suddenly stood out and became more distinct. I whispered Marjorie's name and felt her look up. But before she could say anything, an enormous explosion rocked the jeep. A blast of fire and light shot up from the area in front of us, and the soldiers were blown to the ground. Immediately, our vision was obscured by smoke and falling ash. "Come on!" I yelled, pulling Marjorie from the vehicle. Amid the confusion, we ran down the street in the direction I had been looking. Behind us, I could hear distant shouts and moans. Still engulfed with smoke, we ran perhaps 50 yards. Suddenly, I noticed a doorway to the left. "In here!" I shouted. The door was open, and we both ran inside. I fell against the door, closing it securely. When I turned around, I saw a middle-aged woman staring at us. We had dashed into someone's home. As I looked at her, attempting a smile, I noticed that the woman's expression was not one of horror nor anger at having had two strangers rush into her house after an explosion. Instead, what she displayed was an amused half-smile that looked more like resignation, as though she half expected us and now had to do something. On a chair nearby was a small child, about 4 years old. "Hurry," she said in English. "They will be looking for you." She ushered us to the back of the sparsely furnished living room, through a hall, and down some wooden steps to a long cellar. The child walked at her side. We moved quickly through the cellar and up some other steps to an outside door leading to an alley. The woman unlocked a small compact car, which was parked there, and hurried us inside. She directed us to lie down in the back seat, threw a blanket over us, and pulled away in what seemed to be a northerly direction. Through it all, I remained speechless, carried along by the woman's initiative. A rush of energy filled my body as I fully realized what had happened. My intuition of escape had occurred. Marjorie lay beside me, her eyes tightly closed. "Are you all right?" I whispered. She looked up at me with tearful eyes and nodded. After about 15 minutes, the woman said, "I think you can sit up now." I pushed away the blanket and looked around. We seemed to be on the same road as before the explosion, only further north. "Who are you?" I asked. She turned and looked at me with her half-smile. She was a shapely woman of about 40, with shoulder-length dark hair. "I'm Carla Diaz," she said. "This is my daughter, Maretta." The child was smiling and looking over the passenger seat at us with large, inquisitive eyes. Her hair was jet black and also long. I told them who we were, then asked, "How did you know to help us?" Carla's smile grew wider. "You are running from the soldiers because of the manuscript, aren't you?" "Yes, but how did you know?" "I know the manuscript, too." "Where are you taking us?" I asked. "I don't know that," she said. "You will have to help me." I glanced at Marjorie. She was watching me closely as I spoke. "Right now, I don't know where to go," I said. "Before I was captured, I was trying to get to Iquitos." "Why did you want to go there?" she asked. "I'm trying to find a friend. He's looking for the Ninth Insight. That is a dangerous thing." "I know." "We will take you there, won't we, Maretta?" The little girl giggled and said with a sophistication beyond her years, "Of course." "What kind of explosion was that back there?" I asked. "I think it was a gas truck," she answered. "Earlier, an accident had occurred, a leak." I was still amazed at how quickly Carla had decided to help us, so I decided to press the question. "How did you know we were running from the soldiers?" She took a deep breath. "Yesterday, many military trucks were passing through the village going north. This is unusual, and it made me think of the time 2 months ago when my friends were taken away. My friends and I studied the manuscript together. We were the only ones in this village who had all 8 insights. Then the soldiers came and took my friends. I have not heard from them." "As I watched the trucks yesterday," she continued, "I knew the soldiers were continuing to hunt copies of the manuscript and that others, like my friends, would need help. I envisioned myself helping those people if I could. Of course, I suspected that it was meaningful that I was having that particular thought at that particular time. So when you came into my house, I was not surprised." She paused, then asked, "Have you ever experienced this?" "Yes," I said. Carla slowed the car. Ahead was a crossroads. "I think we should turn to the right here," she said. "It will take longer, but it will be safer." As Carla turned the car to the right, Maretta slid to the left and had to hold on to the seat to keep from falling over. She giggled. Marjorie was staring appreciatively at the little girl. "How old is Maretta?" Marjorie asked Carla. Carla looked disturbed, then said gently, "Please, don't talk about her as if she wasn't here. If she was an adult, you would have addressed the question to her." "Oh, I'm sorry," Marjorie said. "I'm 5, Maretta said proudly. "Have you studied the 8th insight?" Carla asked. "No," Marjorie said. "I have only seen the 3rd insight." "I'm at the 8th, I said. "Do you have any copies?" "No," Carla said. "All the copies were taken away by the soldiers." "Does the 8th talk about how to relate to children?" "Yes. It is about how humans will eventually learn to relate to each other. And talks of many things, such as how to project energy to others and how to avoid addictions to people." There was that warning again. I was about to ask Carla what it meant when Marjorie spoke. "Tell us about the 8th insight," she said. "The 8th insight," Carla explained, "is about using energy in a new way when relating to people in general. But it begins at the beginning, with children." "How should we view children?" I asked. "We should view them as they really are, as end points in evolution that lead us forward. But in order to learn to evolve, they need our energy on a constant basis, unconditionally. The worst thing that can be done to children is to drain their energy while correcting them. This is what creates control dramas in them, as you already know. But these learned manipulations on the child's part can be avoided if the adults give them all the energy they need, no matter what the situation. That is why they should always be included in conversations, especially conversations about them. And you should never take responsibility for more children than you can give attention to. The manuscript says all this? I asked. Yes, she said. And the point about the number of children is highly stressed. I felt confused. Why is the number of children one has important? She glanced at me for an instant as she drove. Because any one adult can only focus on and give attention to one child at a time. If there are too many children for the number of adults, then the adults become overwhelmed and unable to give enough energy. The children begin to compete with each other for the adults' time. Sibling rivalry, I said. Yes, but the manuscript says that this problem is more important than people think. Adults often glamorize the idea of large families and children growing up together, but children should learn the world from adults, not from other children. In too many cultures, children are running in gangs. The manuscript says humans will slowly understand that they should not bring children into the world unless there is at least one adult committed to focus full attention all the time on each child. But wait a minute, I said. In many situations, both parents must work to survive. This denies them the right to have children. Not necessarily, she replied. The manuscript says humans will learn to extend their families beyond blood ties, so that someone else is able to provide one-on-one attention. All the energy does not have to come from the parents alone. In fact, it is better if it does not. But whoever cares for the children must provide this one-on-one attention. Well, I said, you've done something right. Moretta certainly seems mature. Carla frowned and said, don't tell me, tell her. Oh, right, I looked at the child. You act very grown up, Moretta. She looked away shyly for a moment, then said, thank you. Carla hugged her warmly. Carla looked at me proudly. For the last 2 years, I have been trying to relate to Moretta according to the manuscript's guidelines. Haven't I, Moretta? The child smiled and nodded. I have tried to give her energy and to always tell her the truth of every situation in language she can understand. When she asked the questions a young child asks, I treated them very seriously, avoiding the temptation of giving her a fanciful answer which is plainly for the entertainment of adults. I smiled. Do you mean untruths like storks bring babies, that sort of thing? Yes. But these cultural expressions aren't so bad. Children figure these out quickly because they stay the same. Worse are the distortions created on the spot by adults just because they want to have a little fun, and because they believe the truth is too complicated for a child to comprehend. But this is not right. The truth can always be expressed at a child's level of understanding. It just takes some thought. What does the manuscript say about this issue? It says we should always find a way to tell a child the truth. Part of me resisted this idea. I was one who enjoyed kidding around with children. Don't kids usually understand that adults are just playing? I said. All this seems to make them grow up too fast and take some of the fun out of childhood. She looked at me sternly. Moretta is full of fun. We chase and tumble and play all the childhood fantasy games. The difference is that when we are fantasizing, she knows it. I nodded. She was right, of course. Moretta seems confident, Carla continued, because I was there for her. I gave her one-on-one attention when she needed it. And if I wasn't there, my sister who lives next door was there. She always had an adult to answer her questions, and because she has had this sincere attention, she has never felt she had to act out or show off. She has always had enough energy, and that makes her assume she will continue to have enough, which makes the transition from receiving energy from adults to getting it from the universe which we already talk about, much easier for her to grasp. I noticed the terrain outside. We were traveling through deep jungle now, and though I couldn't see it, I knew the sun was low in the afternoon sky. "Can we get to Iquitos tonight?" I asked. "No," Carla said, "but we can stay at a house I know." "Near here?" I asked. "Yes, it is the house of a friend. He works for the Wildlife Service." "He works for the government?" "Some of the Amazon is a protected area. He is the local agent, but influential. His name is Juan Hinton. Do not worry, he believes in the manuscript, and they have never bothered him." By the time we arrived, the sky was completely dark. Around us, the jungle was alive with night sounds, the air muggy. A large, well-lit wood-frame house stood at the end of a clearing in the dense foliage. Nearby were two large buildings and several jeeps. Another vehicle was up on blocks, and two men worked around lights underneath. A thin Peruvian, dressed in expensive clothing, answered Carla's knock and smiled at her until he noticed Marjorie, Moretta, and myself waiting on the steps. His face turned nervous and displeased as he talked to her in Spanish. She said something pleadingly in return, but his mannerism and inflection indicated he did not want us to stay. Then, through the crack in the door, I noticed a lone female figure standing in the foyer. I moved a little to bring her face into view. It was Julia. As I looked, she turned her head and saw me, then quickly walked forward with a surprised look on her face. She touched the shoulder of the man at the door and said something quietly into his ear. The man nodded, then opened the door with a look of resignation. We all introduced ourselves as Hinton led the way into the den area. Julia looked at me and said, "We meet again." She wore khaki pants with pockets on the legs and a bright red T-shirt. "Yes, we do," I said. A Peruvian servant stopped Hinton, and after talking for a minute, the two walked into another part of the house. Julia sat in a chair by a coffee table and motioned for the rest of us to sit on the couch across from her. Marjorie appeared panicked. She looked at me intensely. Carla also seemed to be aware of Marjorie's distress. She walked over and took her by the hand. "Let's get some hot tea," she suggested. As they walked away, Marjorie glanced back at me. I smiled and watched them until they turned the corner into the kitchen. Then I turned to face Julia. "So, what do you think it means?" she asked. "What does what mean?" I replied, still distracted. "That we have run into each other again." "Oh, I don't know." "How did you wind up with Carla, and where are you going?" "She saved us. Marjorie and I had been detained by the Peruvian troops. When we escaped, she happened to be there to help us." Julia looked intense. "Tell me what occurred." I leaned back and told her the whole story, beginning at the point in which I had taken Father Carl's truck, and then all about the capture and our eventual escape. "And Carla agreed to take you to Iquitos?" Julia asked. "Yes." "Why do you want to go there?" "That's where Will told Father Carl he was going. Will apparently has a lead about the Ninth Insight. Also, Sebastian is there for some reason." Julia nodded. "Yes, Sebastian has a mission near there. It's where he made his reputation, converting the Indians." "What about you?" I asked. "What are you doing here?" Julia told me she too wanted to find the Ninth Insight, but that she had no leads. She had come to this house after thinking repeatedly of her old friend Hinton. I was hardly listening. Marjorie and Carla had walked out of the kitchen and were standing in the hall talking, cups of tea in their hands. Marjorie caught my eye, but said nothing. "Has she read much of the manuscript?" Julia asked, nodding toward Marjorie. "Just the Third Insight," I said. "We can probably get her out of Peru if that's what she wants." I turned and looked at her. "How?" "Rolando is leaving tomorrow for Brazil. We have some friends at the American Embassy there. They can get her back to the United States. We have helped other Americans this way." I looked at her and nodded tentatively. I realized I was having mixed feelings about what she had said. Part of me knew that leaving would be best for Marjorie, but another part wanted her to stay, to remain with me. I felt changed, energized when she was around. I think I need to talk with her, I finally said. Of course, Julia replied. We can talk later. I got up and walked toward her. Carla was heading back toward the kitchen. Marjorie stepped around the corner of the hall out of sight. When I walked up, she was leaning back against the wall. I pulled Marjorie into my arms. My body pulsated. Feel that energy? I asked, whispering into her ear. It's incredible, she said. What does it mean? I don't know. We have some kind of connection. I glanced around. No one could see us. We kissed passionately. When I pulled back to look at her face, she looked different, stronger somehow. And I thought back to the day we had met at Vicente and to the conversation in the restaurant at Kula. I couldn't believe the amount of energy I felt in her presence and when she touched me. She held me tightly. Since that day at Vicente, she said, I've wanted to be with you. I didn't know what to think about it then, but the energy is wonderful. I've never experienced anything like this. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed Carla walking up smiling. She told us that dinner was ready, so we made our way into the dining room and found a huge buffet of fresh fruits and vegetables and breads. Everyone served their plates and sat around a large table. After Moretta sang a blessing song, we spent an hour and a half eating and talking casually. Hinton had lost his nervousness, and he set a light-hearted mood which helped to ease the tension of our escape. Marjorie was talking freely and laughing. Sitting beside her filled me with warm love. After dinner, Hinton took us back into the den where a custard dessert was served with a sweet liqueur. Marjorie and I sat on the couch and fell into a long conversation about our pasts and significant life experiences. We seemed to grow closer and closer. The only difficulty we discovered was that she lived on the West Coast and I resided in the South. Later, Marjorie dismissed the problem and laughed heartily. I can't wait until we get back to the United States, she said. We'll have so much fun traveling back and forth. I sat back and gave her a serious look. Julia said that she could arrange a way for you to go home now. You mean both of us, don't you? She replied. No, I can't go. Why? She asked. I can't leave without you. But I can't stand to stay here any longer either. I'll go crazy. You'll have to go ahead. I'll be able to leave soon. No, she said loudly. I can't stand that. Carla, who was walking back into the den from putting Moretta to bed, glanced toward us. She looked quickly away. Hinton and Julia were still talking, seemingly oblivious to Marjorie's outburst. Please, Marjorie said, let's just go home. I looked away. Okay, fine, she said. Stay. She stood and walked briskly towards the bedroom area. My gut wrenched as I watched Marjorie walk away. The energy I had gained with her collapsed, and I suddenly felt weak and confused. I tried to shake it off. After all, I told myself, I hadn't known her that long. On the other hand, I thought, maybe she was correct. Maybe I should just go home. What difference could I make here anyway? Back at home, I could perhaps marshal some support for the manuscript and stay alive as well. I stood up and started to follow her down the hall, but for some reason, I sat back down. I couldn't decide what to do. May I join you for a minute? Carla was suddenly asking. I hadn't noticed that she was standing beside the sofa. Sure, I said. She sat down and looked at me with regard. I couldn't help overhearing what is going on, she said. And I thought that before you made your decision, you might want to hear what the Eighth Insight says about addictions to people. Yes, please. I want to know what that means. When one first learns to be clear and to engage one's evolution, any of us can be stopped suddenly by an addiction to another person. You're speaking of Marjorie and me, aren't you? Let me explain the process, she said, and you judge for yourself. Okay. First, Let me say that I had a very hard time with this part of the insight. I don't think I would have ever understood if I had not met Professor Renault. Renault? I exclaimed. I know him. We met when I was learning the fourth insight. Well, she said, we met when we both had reached the eighth insight. He stayed at my house for several days. I nodded in amazement. He said that the idea of an addiction, as used in the manuscript, explains why power struggles arise in romantic relationships. We've always wondered what causes the bliss and euphoria of love to end, to suddenly turn into conflict, and now we know. It is a result of the flow of energy between the individuals involved. When love first happens, the two individuals are giving each other energy unconsciously, and both people feel buoyant and elated. That's the incredible high we all call being in love. Unfortunately, once they expect this feeling to come from the other person, they cut themselves off from the energy in the universe and begin to rely even more on the energy from each other. Only now there doesn't seem to be enough, and so they stop giving each other energy and fall back into their dramas in an attempt to control each other and force the other's energy their way. At this point, the relationship degenerates into the usual power struggle. She hesitated for a moment, as if checking whether I understood, then added, Renault told me that our susceptibility to this kind of addiction can be described psychologically, if that will help you understand. I nodded again for her to continue. Renault said, the problem starts in our early family. Because of the energy competition there, none of us were able to complete an important psychological process. We weren't able to integrate our opposite sexual side. Our what? In my case, she continued, I wasn't able to integrate my male side. In your case, you weren't able to integrate your female side. The reason we can become addicted to someone of the opposite sex is that we've yet to access this opposite sex energy ourselves. You see, the mystical energy that we can tap as an inner source is both male and female. We can eventually open up to it, but when we first begin to evolve, we have to be careful. The integration process takes some time. If we connect prematurely with a human source for our female or male energy, we block the universal supply. I told her I didn't understand. Think of how this integration is supposed to work in an ideal family, she explained. And then perhaps you can see what I mean. In any family, the child must first receive energy from the adults in his life. Usually, identifying with and integrating the energy of the same-sexed parent is accomplished easily. But receiving energy from the other parent can be more difficult because of the differences in the sexes. Let's use a female child as an example. All the little girl knows, as she first attempts to integrate her male side, is that she is extremely attracted to her father. She wants him around and close to her all the time. The manuscript explains that what she really wants is male energy, because this male energy complements her female side. From this male energy, she receives a sense of completion and euphoria. But she mistakenly thinks that the only way to have this energy is by sexually possessing her father and keeping him close physically. Interestingly, because she intuits that this energy is really supposed to be her own and that she should be able to command this energy at will, she wants to direct the father as if he were that part of herself. She thinks he is magical and perfect and able to supply her every whim. In a less than ideal family, this sets up a power conflict between the little girl and her dad. Dramas are formed as she learns to posture herself in order to manipulate him into giving her the energy she desires. But in an ideal family, the father would remain uncompetitive. He would continue to relate honestly and have enough energy so as to supply her unconditionally, even though he can't do everything she asks. The important thing to know here, in our ideal example, is that the father would remain open and communicative. She thinks he is ideal and magical. But if he honestly explains who he is and what he is doing and why, then the little girl can integrate his particular style and abilities and proceed past an unrealistic view of her father. In the end, she will see him as just a particular human being, a human being with his own talents and faults. Once this true emulation takes place, then the child makes an easy transition from receiving her opposite sex energy from her father to receiving it as part of the overall energy existing in the universe at large. The problem, she went on, is that most parents, up to now, have been competing with their own children for energy, and that has affected all of us. Because this competition was taking place, none of us have quite resolved this opposite sex issue. We're all stuck at the stage where we are still looking for our opposite sex energy outside of ourselves, in the person of a male or female we can think of as ideal and magical and can possess sexually. See the problem? Yes, I said, I think I do. In terms of our ability to evolve consciously, she continued, we are faced with a critical situation. As I said before, according to the Eighth Insight, when we first begin to evolve, we automatically begin to receive our opposite sex energy. It comes in naturally from the energy in the universe. But we must be careful, because if another person comes along who offers this energy directly, we can cut ourselves off from the true source and regress. She chuckled to herself. What are you laughing at? I asked. Renaud once made this analogy, she said. He said that until we learn how to avoid this situation, we are walking around like a circle, half complete. You know, we look like the letter C. We are very susceptible to a person of the opposite sex, some other circle half complete, coming up and joining with us, completing the circle that way, and giving us a burst of euphoria and energy that feels like the wholeness that a full connection with the universe produces. In reality, we have only joined up with another person who is looking for their other half on the outside too. Renaud said that this is a classical codependent relationship and that it has built-in problems that begin to arise immediately. She hesitated, as though she expected me to say something, but I only nodded. You see, the problem with this completed person, this O, that both people think they have reached, is that it has taken two people to make this one whole person, one supplying the female energy and one supplying the male. This one whole person consequently has two heads, or egos. Both people want to run this whole person they have created, and so, just as in childhood, both people want to command the other, as if the other were themselves. This kind of illusion of completeness always breaks down into a power struggle. In the end, each person must take the other for granted and even invalidate them so that they can lead this whole self in the direction they want to go. But of course, that doesn't work, at least not anymore. Perhaps in the past, one of the partners was willing to submit themselves to the other, usually the woman, sometimes the man. But we are waking up now. No one wants to be subservient to anyone else any longer. I thought of what the First Insight had conveyed about power struggles within intimate relationships, and of the woman's outburst at the restaurant with Charlene. So much for romance, I said. Oh, we can still have romance, Carla replied. But first we have to complete the circle on our own. We have to stabilize our channel with the universe. That takes time. But afterward, we are never susceptible to this problem again, and we can have what the manuscript calls a higher relationship. When we connect romantically with another person after that, we create a super person. But it never pulls us from the path of our individual evolution. Which is what you think Marjorie and I are doing to each other now, isn't it? Pulling ourselves off the paths. Yes. So how do we avoid these encounters? I asked. By resisting the love-at-first-sight feeling for a while. By learning to have platonic relationships with members of the opposite sex. But remember the process. You must have these relationships only with people who will reveal themselves totally, telling you how and why they are doing what they are doing, just as this would have happened with the opposite-sexed parent during an ideal childhood. By understanding who these opposite-sex friends really are on the inside, one breaks past one's own fantasy projection about that gender, and that releases us to connect again with the universe. Remember also, she continued, that this is not easy, especially if one has to break away from a current codependent relationship. It is a real pulling apart of energy. It hurts, but it must be done. Codependence is not some new malady some of us have. We're all codependent, and we're all growing out of it now. The idea is to begin to experience that sense of well-being and euphoria experienced in the first moment of a codependent relationship when you are alone. You get to have him or her on the inside. After that, you evolve forward and can find that special romantic relationship that really fits you. She paused. And who knows, if both you and Marjorie evolve further, perhaps you will find that you truly belong with each other. But understand, your relationship with her has no way of working now. Our conversation was interrupted as Hinton walked over and explained that he was retiring for the night, and that our rooms had been prepared. We both expressed our appreciation for his hospitality, and as he walked away, Carla said, "I think I'm going to bed also. We'll talk later." I nodded and watched her as she left. Then I felt a hand on my shoulder. It was Julia. "I'm going to my room," she said. "Do you know where yours is? I can show you." "Please," I said, then asked, "Where is Marjorie's room?" She smiled as we walked down the hall and stopped in front of a particular door. "Nowhere near yours," she said. "Mr. Hinton is a very conservative man." I smiled back and bid her good night, then entered my room and held my stomach until I went to sleep. I awoke to the smell of rich coffee. The aroma permeated the entire house. After I dressed, I walked into the den. An older male housekeeper offered me a glass of fresh grape juice, which I accepted. "Good morning," Julia said from behind me. I turned around. "Good morning." She looked at me intensely, then asked, "Have you discovered yet why we've run into each other again?" "No," I said. "I haven't been able to think about it. I've been trying to understand addictions." "Yes," she replied. "I saw." "What do you mean?" "I could tell what was happening by the way your energy field looked." "How did it look?" I asked. "Your energy was connected to Marjorie's. When you were sitting here and she was sitting in the other room, your field stretched all the way in there and attached to hers." I shook my head. She smiled and put her hand on my shoulder. "You had lost your connection with the universe. You had become addicted to Marjorie's energy as a substitute." "It's the same way with all addictions. One goes through someone or something else to connect with the universe. The way to deal with this is to get your energy up and then center yourself again in what you are really doing here." I nodded and walked outside. She waited in the den. For about 10 minutes I practiced the method of building energy that Sanchez had taught me. Gradually the beauty returned, and I felt much lighter. I returned to the house. "You look better," Julia said. "I feel better," I replied. "So, what are your questions at this point?" I thought for a minute. I had found Marjorie. That question had been answered. But I still wanted to find out where Will was, and I still wanted to understand how people would be acting toward each other if they follow this manuscript. If the manuscript's effect was positive, why would Sebastian and the other priests be worried? I looked at Julia. "I need to grasp the rest of the eighth insight, and I still want to find Will. Maybe he has the ninth." "I'm going to Iquitos tomorrow," she said. "Would you like to go?" I hesitated. "I think Will is there," she added. "How do you know?" "Because of the thoughts I had about him last night." I said nothing. "I had thoughts of you, too," Julia continued. "Of both of us going to Iquitos. You're involved in this somehow." "Involved in what?" I asked. She grinned. In finding this last insight before Sebastian does. As she spoke, the image came to my mind of Julie and me arriving at Iquitos, but then deciding to go in separate directions for some reason. I felt I had a purpose, but it was unclear. I focused again on Julia. She was smiling. "Where were you?" she asked. "Sorry," I said. "I was thinking about something. Was it important?" "I don't know. I was thinking that once we get to Iquitos, that we would go in two different directions." Rolando came into the room. "I brought the supplies you wanted," he said to Julia. He recognized me and nodded politely. "Good, thank you," Julia replied. "Did you see many soldiers?" "No, I did not see any," he said. Marjorie walked into the room then and distracted me, but I could hear Julia explaining to Rolando that she thought Marjorie wanted to go with him to Brazil, where she would arrange passage back to the States. I went over to Marjorie. "How did you sleep?" I asked. She looked at me as though deciding whether to remain angry. "Not very well," she said. I nodded toward Rolando. "He is Julia's friend. He is leaving this morning for Brazil. From there, he'll help you get back to the States." She appeared frightened. "Look, you're going to be okay," I said. "They've helped other Americans. They know people at the American Embassy in Brazil. In no time, you'll be home." She nodded. "I'm worried about you." "I'll be fine, don't worry. As soon as I get back to the U.S., I'll call you." From behind me, Hinton announced that breakfast was being served. We walked into the dining room and ate. Afterward, Julia and Rolando seemed to be in a hurry. Julia explained that it was important for Rolando and Marjorie to get across the border before dark, and the journey would take all day. Marjorie packed some clothes that Hinton had given her, and later, while Julia and Rolando were talking by the door, I pulled Marjorie to the side. "Don't worry about anything," I said. "Just keep your eyes open, and perhaps you'll see the other insights." She smiled, but said nothing. I watched with Julia as Rolando helped her load her things into his small car. Her eyes met mine briefly as they drove away. "Do you think they will get through all right?" I asked Julia. She looked at me and winked. "Of course. And now we had better go as well. I have some clothes for you." She handed me a satchel of clothes, and we loaded these and several boxes of food stuff into the pickup truck. We then said goodbye to Hinton and Carla and Moretta, and drove northeast toward Iquitos.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.